Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, the headline across the top of the page, Potential Pension Losses Put at $298 Million. This article is written by Lee Weisbecker with the Dateline of Raleigh. State pension officials have set aside millions more to cover potential investment losses, even as they filed suit against a New York bank to recover a portion of the cash. As of June 30, nearly $162 million, $16 million more than in early 2011, has been put aside in a special reserve account to cover the possible losses in North Carolina's securities lending program. Those potential losses, also as of June 30, were put at $298 million. The set-aside figure and loss estimates were included by State Controller David McCoy in North Carolina's recently released Comprehensive Annual Financial Report for Fiscal 2012. Asked to comment on the new figures, Julia Vale, spokeswoman for State Treasurer Janet Cowell, says the pace of setting aside cash will pick up even more in the coming months. The department plans over the next year to begin the process of increasing the reserve to cover the entire remaining unrealized loss, she says. Under securities lending, the North Carolina pension system makes a portion of its stock holdings temporarily available to hedge funds, brokers, and other market makers for short selling and other trading activities. In exchange, the borrowers give the state collateral in the form of cash, which is invested, usually in short-term deals for a quick return. Once the hedge funds and other traders have completed their transaction using North Carolina stock, a similar block of shares is returned to the state, and the state returns the traders cash. The process worked automatically until the financial crisis of 2008. According to McCoy's report, several investments made in the state's name using its securities lending collateral lost value and began showing potential losses. The one that has drawn the most attention was the $95 million investment made by Bank of New York Mellon in Lehman Brothers notes, which lost 74% of their value, about $70 million, when Lehman failed, touching off a worldwide financial crisis in the fall of 2008. The state filed suit to recover the money in a case that's still pending before the North Carolina Business Court. It isn't the only state pension system to take such a step. In nearby South Carolina, pension officials also sued BNY Mellon for the same reason. That case involves $200 million in alleged Lehman-related losses, says Ben Wilkie of Security Lending Times. Besides the Lehman letter, North Carolina's other problem investments and the amounts involved have never been identified. Meanwhile, the state pension fund continues operating a scaled-down version of a securities lending program. The proceeds from that program are being stockpiled in a special $162 million account against the day when the $298 million in potential losses facing the state turn real. Now, below that article, the rest of the front page of the Triangle Business Journal is taken up by two articles. They're inside of a black border. About three-fourths of that space from the leftover has first a picture at the top of three people in a hospital wearing white coats with stethoscopes around their neck looking at a computer. The caption reads, Dr. Evan Ashkin with residents Dr. Mimi Miles and Dr. Christina Drosten at UNC Hospitals in Chapel Hill. Then under that, it's separated into two sections. First on the left, the headline in bold black lettering, The Residency Bottleneck, Costly Hospital Training a Major Factor in Physician Shortage. And then next to that, the first article begins, which is written by Jason DeBrun with the Dateline of Chapel Hill, as both articles are. And then on the very bottom of this section, there's also a number of graphs that are headlined, Getting Paid Per Resident, Payment by Medicare to Local Hospitals to Run Their Residency Programs. And some of those numbers for each individual hospital we'll get to in the article. Healthcare experts agree nearly unanimously that the nation is facing a severe shortage of doctors and physician assistants, especially in primary care, and are beginning to ask themselves how to fix the problem, Tucked below the surface of the policy debate is a problem in physician residency programs that health experts say must be fixed to provide appropriate care to Americans. In an article for medical magazine Med Monthly, Dr. Robert Center, a member of the American College of Physicians, writes that the real bottleneck that limits the number of physicians is the lack of available residency positions in the U.S. We have a paradox of increasing medical student production while our residency production remains stagnant, and if not corrected, this problem will cause the physician shortage to get worse, he writes. At the Cecil G. Shepp Center for Health Services Research, part of UNC Chapel Hill, researchers echo Center's concerns. By their count, North Carolina has fewer residents per capita than the national average, and they predict that gap will widen. Hospitals that train residents are called teaching hospitals and receive subsidies through Medicare, but hospital executives say that the reimbursements don't keep up with costs. At Wake Med Health and Hospitals in Raleigh, for example, the total cost of training residents in 2011 came to $11 million, or $229,019 per full-time equivalent resident. The direct graduate medical education reimbursement was less than $3 million, or only $60,558 per resident, according to Joe Baker, who works in the reimbursement department at Wake Med. Teaching hospitals also receive indirect medical education reimbursements. Wake Med filed for $6.5 million in reimbursements last year. That is subject to a settlement, but Baker said those should not be considered in covering the direct costs of training residents. These payments are to cover the increased cost of patient care because we are a teaching hospital, he says. UNC Hospitals naturally has a larger residency program than Wake Med. Last year, its training costs came to $43 million, but it received $13 million in direct medical education reimbursements. It, too, received more in indirect costs, but officials agree with Baker that many of those reimbursements go to cover additional care, as these teaching hospitals are expected to see patients with complex diseases. Duke University Hospital is also a teaching hospital, but did not respond to multiple requests for information for this article. Some in the field call graduate education an enigma that the profession must figure out soon. When it comes to the cost of graduate medical education, we are at a loss to explain much of anything, wrote Dr. John Saltz, editor of Family Medicine, in a September 2011 editorial. Although family medicine residencies have been around for more than 40 years, we understand too little about how much they cost and how this expense is changing. Research published by Dr. Sarah Lesko of the University of Washington shows that GME payment can vary from $52,778 to $197,118 per resident annually. Furthermore, that research did not look at every teaching hospital, and researchers say payments are probably even more disparate. This variation is well known to those who study GME funding, but nearly impossible to justify to anyone else, wrote Saltz. The physician shortage is especially pronounced at the family physician or primary care level. Fewer than 10% of medical school graduates go into family practice, says Dr. John Kaufman, dean and chief academic officer of the New School of Osteopathic Medicine at Campbell University. In North Carolina, 20 counties don't have a general surgeon, he adds. We need to develop more residency programs in North Carolina, he says matter-of-factly. Our population is growing much faster than our ability to train physicians. To be sure, hospitals could add residency slots at their own expense, but Kaufman does not see that as a viable option. How many millions of dollars can hospitals afford to eat? He asks rhetorically. Asking a hospital to flip the bill is not realistic. And the second article, also written by Jason DeBrun with a Dateline of Chapel Hill, is headlined, Solutions Elusive, Experts in the Field Say. Those in the medical profession agree that creating more physician residency slots is a nut that might prove hard to crack. There are varying estimates, but by most accounts, the United States healthcare system will experience a shortage of 100,000 doctors by 2020. The Association of American Medical Colleges estimates that will include a shortage of 45,000 primary care physicians and has called for medical schools to increase overall enrollment by 30%. Increasing the number of medical school graduates without increasing the number of residency slots, however, will only make the top residency programs more competitive and could lead to more medical school graduates who don't go on to become doctors. In North Carolina, the UNC Chapel Hill, Duke University in Durham, Wake Forest University in Winston-Salem, and East Carolina University in Greenville combined for a maximum of 478 medical students per class, according to data provided by the Cecil G. Shepp Center for Health Services Research, part of UNC Chapel Hill. If everything goes according to plan in Buies Creek, a new school of osteopathic medicine at Campbell University will add 150 students per class to that number when it enrolls students in 2013. Not everyone sees a solution as simply as increasing funding for residency slots. Consider Dr. Peter Ubel, a professor at Duke University's Fuqua School of Business. He takes issue with the sweeping statement of a physician shortage and says doomsday threats of those kind have been overblown. Are there really not enough orthopedic surgeons, he says? Do we not have enough anesthesiologists? The real problem, as others have noted, is in primary care and pediatrics, particularly in rural areas, where pay is sometimes drastically below what specialists will earn. When students graduate from medical school, they will often apply for residency programs that offer the best path toward a high-paying specialty. Those who don't qualify then scramble for a primary care spot, Ubel says. Repeating a topic he harps on in his classes, Ubel says much of this happens because the medical market is just very different than any other market. Many traditional laws of supply and demand don't work because of regulations and how the third-party payer system distorts the industry. To truly crack the physician shortage, Ubel and others suggest a shift in how medical providers give care, particularly at the primary care level. It's unlikely that salaries for primary care will catch up with specialties, yet those doctors must still go through the lengthy process of medical school and residency, leaving them with mountains of debt. Instead, he recommends a broader network of mid-level providers like physician assistants and nurse practitioners who could move through school more quickly and not require lengthy residency programs. The cost of not addressing this problem far exceeds the cost of solving it, says Dr. Robert Center, a member of the American College of Physicians. We who train students and residents understand this, but apparently politicians don't realize and need to learn that inadequate residency training will have an obvious negative impact on healthcare outcomes. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column. The headline that starts it off, and I should note this is Best of Biz, the headline, Take a Biz Stroll on Memory Lane. Each year, we take a walk down memory lane by offering up some of the tastiest nuggets from our Biz column throughout the year. Here is Best of Biz for 2012. One member of the private investor group that sank $30 million into now-defunct ethanol producer Clean Burn Fuels, Capital Broadcasting's Jim Goodman, says the experience reinforces an old adage, you take your licks, he says, and you get on with it. I think there were about 60 of us investing in that, Goodman recently told Biz. We thought it was great to set up a business in Hoke County. We believe that anything that replaces oil is good, but that renewable energy makes sense. And that was from January 13, 2012. Thin from the effects of an accident, but marching on, NAI Carolantic Realty Chairman Steve Stroud was given a standing ovation at his firm's annual commercial real estate conference on January 18 at the RBC Center. Stroud was severely injured in a tractor accident while tending to his 97-acre farm in Lee County in October and has been mostly confined to a wheelchair since the incident. January 27, 2012. Lynx magazine recently ranked the best golf course renovations of 2011, and the top two were in North Carolina. Ben Crenshaw got a lot of ink for his remake of the fabled Pinehurst No. 2, which Lynx calls the best renovation of the year. Not much has been said, though, of Baldhead Island Golf Course, which got the magazine's No. 2 ranking. The $4 million Baldhead renovation was overseen by Tim Cate, a noted golf course designer who lives in Sunset Beach. February 24, 2012. Longtime Raleigh Manpower franchise owner Jeff Stocks is off and running again, or shall we say sailing. Stocks and Art Burke have launched the Nautical Group, an executive search firm in Raleigh. Stocks, who helped build Manpower's Raleigh business into the largest in North America and third largest in the world, will be operating out of his Manpower building on Wade Avenue. I want to build a company that eventually will assist companies find executives across the globe, he says. We are focused on hiring C-level execs, senior VPs, and executive VPs. That's our space. March 9th, 2012. As PNC Bank removes the last remnants of RBC Bank across the triangle, folks at Cirque du Soleil will forever be a part of the history of the building that as of March 15 will be the venue formerly known as the RBC Center. Cirque was the last show hosted by the RBC Center before becoming PNC Arena. March 16, 2012. The work of Dr. Charles Hamner has been evident for years. Now it's official. He's been bestowed with the Nano Business Pioneer Award for his 50-plus years of service to the fields of science as longtime head of the North Carolina Biotechnology Center. The award was presented during the Nanotechnology Commercialization Conference early this month, April 13, 2012. That's one expensive head protector. With the season over, Cam Ward didn't need his hockey mask any longer, so the Carolina Hurricanes goalie donated it for auction to benefit Special Olympics North Carolina. It sold for $6,000 through the Carolina Hurricanes Kids and Community Foundation. April 20, 2012. Born into what is arguably North Carolina's premier banking family, Frank B. Holding Jr. has picked up lessons learned on his way to taking over as chairman and CEO of Raleigh-based First Citizens Bank Shares and its First Citizens Bank subsidiary. He shared some of those lessons on May 5 when he delivered the commencement address to 160 graduates of Methodist University in Fayetteville. Holding gave six pieces of advice he has learned from his career. There are opportunities out there, even in difficult times. Character is essential. Always keep your life's checkbook balanced. Relationships matter. Invest in long-term growth. And take all you've invested in yourself and give back with interest. May 11, 2012. Is the circus in town? Biz could have sworn there was a clown car in downtown Raleigh last week. On the way to the press conference at the North Carolina Commerce Department's building on June 7 to learn about Citrix's expansion into downtown Raleigh, Biz counted at least four Raleigh City Council members, plus two of the city's economic development staffers, piling out of the same car on their way to the announcement. Raleigh Councilwoman Marianne Baldwin confirmed that she and five others, including Mayor Nancy McFarlane and Councilman Eugene Weeks and Russ Stevenson, hitched a ride from the Raleigh Municipal Complex to the Commerce Department's building five blocks away. They were joined by Raleigh Economic Development leaders James Sauls and Dwight Bassett. But were there even enough seatbelts for all the occupants? I'm the chair of the Public Safety Committee, so I've got it covered, Baldwin said. June 15, 2012. William Peace University in Raleigh has received reaffirmation of its accreditation, a process it goes through every decade. The university, which is entering its first year as a co-ed institution, receives accreditation from the Commission on Colleges of the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools, which is based in Decatur, Georgia, and announces the accreditation status of its member universities twice a year. A small group of vocal alumni had called Peace's accreditation into question, but SACS fully reaffirmed the status. June 29, 2012. Dennis Gillings, co-founder of Durham clinical research organization Quintiles, has tied the knot. Gillings and Mariel Gingras were wed over the Labor Day weekend. Quintiles did not have any official comment on the nuptials and would not provide details on what spokesperson Phil Bridges calls a private ceremony. Gingras is the president and CEO of San Diego-based Huya, H-U-Y-A, Bioscience International, a company that touts itself as a leader in globalizing Chinese pharmaceutical innovation. August 9, 2012. It took 186 days, but retired Raleigh banker Colin Terrell completed his walk from Cape Hatteras to Santa Monica, California, a trek of 3,275 miles he undertook to raise awareness for heart health, for the final leg of 7.5 miles that ended at the Santa Monica Pier. Terrell was accompanied by family, including his wife of 45 years, and friends. September 14, 2012. Ramses is dead. Long live Ramses. UNC Chapel Hill has a new ram as its mascot due to the untimely death of 2-year-old Bam Bam, who died of a ruptured kidney in March, only a month after becoming Ramses. Now welcome, after becoming Ramses 19, now welcome Ramses 20, a babe at the age of just 7 months. He made his debut at UNC's football home opener against Elon and performed well. The new Ram's real name, by the way, is Rocky, and that's not as in Rocky Top for curious Tennessee fans. September 21st, 2012. Tom Hendrickson is well known in these parts for his business acumen and for his power broker role in Democratic Party politics, but a dog breeder too. Sure enough, Hendrickson recently shared on his Facebook page the tale of the exhausting experience that Dixie, his German short-haired pointer, had beginning at 7:07 p.m. on September 30. That's when Dixie gave birth to her pup, Number One. It was not until nearly 14 hours later at 9 a.m. on October 1 that Dixie delivered Number 11. Hendrickson informed those following Dixie's day, "The 11th and presumably last puppy was born around 9 a.m. will be just in time to make great Christmas presents." Some wag weighed in with this, "A whole litter of yellow dog Dems." October 5, 2012. Students recently pitched in and ran in memory of Eve Carson, the UNC Chapel Hill student body president who was murdered in March 2008, and raised more than $52,000 that will go toward endowing a scholarship in her name and to two education nonprofits, First Book and CEO for Teens. November 16, 2012. The Pittsburgh Pirates baseball organization is using software developed by Carey's SaaS Incorporated to boost ticket sales and decipher fan feedback. Using SaaS for sports software, Pirates ticket managers have been able to identify accounts at greatest risk of not renewing season tickets. Armed with this information, sales representatives were able to focus on those at-risk clients, resulting in a 6% increase in ticket renewals over the previous season. November 30, 2012. Don't be surprised if you see a PGA Tour pro or two hanging out around the Triangle. Top players including Corey Pavin, Larry Mize, Lee Jansen, and Peter Jacobson have been spotted at Old Chatham Golf Club, a private club in northern Chatham County. The course at Old Chatham is just as competitive as the courses that you see on the PGA Tour, which attracts professional golfers in the area, says John Marino, Old Chatham Director of Operations. It's no surprise, then, that Webb Simpson was a member at Old Chatham for 2 years before moving to Charlotte. December 7, 2012. After heading up operations for luxury home builder Toll Brothers for almost 18 years in the Triangle, Tom Anhut is leaving the company. Biz Hears Anhut will be working with Toll until the end of the year and will be assisting Toll Division President Dave Kelly in the transition. No word on what's next for Anhut, but here's hoping he stays in the Triangle. December 14, 2012. And now we return to the full-length articles in the Triangle Business Journal. The first one we come to has the headline, DHHS Real Estate Deal Looks Iffy at Best. And this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Raleigh. And also included in this article, there's a headshot of Governor Beverly Perdue. And also a picture, an aerial photo of a building. The caption reads, "The Park Center buildings were being considered by the DHHS." Time is running out for any state-funded lease deal for a 1-million-square-foot office project consolidating the State Department of Health and Human Services local staff onto one site. State government officials had intended to finalize the ambitious lease agreement before January 1, 2013, with one of the 10 local developer teams that submitted lease proposals in August. But Governor-elect Pat McCrory is scheduled to be sworn into office on January 5, and no one involved in the DHHS selection process expects a deal to happen before the deadline. And now questions have surfaced whether the plan will ever become reality. Our prediction was always a 50-50 chance that it would happen, says Greg Sandruder, a Raleigh real estate developer who had teamed up with the owners of the 5401 North property in North Raleigh to pitch a plan to build a new office campus for DHHS at that site. Other local developers who had submitted site proposals included Duke Realty, Highwoods Properties, Tri Properties, Craig Davis Properties, Kane Realty, Lookout Ventures, Red Rock Developments, and the Keith Corporation. Governor Beverly Perdue and DHHS officials announced in July that they wanted to consolidate the agency's 4,300 employees in Wake County into one office campus, with preference given to locations close to the Dorothea Dix Hospital campus in downtown Raleigh. DHHS currently occupies office, clinical, and warehouse space in about 30 buildings in Wake County. The agency estimated it would need between 800,000 and 1 million square feet of office, research, and warehouse space, and that it would also need the first 600,000 square feet of space to be available for occupancy no later than June 2014. The lease agreement would be for 20 years with 4 5-year renewal options. Spiros Phlegas, Senior Deputy Secretary at the North Carolina Department of Administration, which has been evaluating the proposals on behalf of DHHS, says his staff hasn't stopped working on the proposals. It is still an active process. No proposal has been discounted, Phlegas says, but he also notes that he can't provide any kind of timeline for a deal. With the change of administration coming in, I'm unable to provide a timeline or any other further comment. Any lease contract between the state and a private developer would also have to be approved by the Council of State, which is composed of 9 statewide elected officials. The council doesn't have another meeting scheduled before the end of the year. McCrory's office did not respond to a request for comment. The state property office had hired the Avison Young commercial real estate firm in Raleigh to assist with its analysis of the developer proposals, but Avison Young managing director John Linderman says he's expecting no decision from the state before the end of the year. And now we turn to the A Better World page, news about people and groups in the Triangle making a difference with their giving and philanthropic activities. First, we start with the nonprofit news. GlaxoSmithKline awarded $200,000 to 5 recipients, 4 in Greensboro, in its annual GlaxoSmithKline Impact Awards. With the $40,000, each healthcare nonprofit will increase access healthcare for the underserved in their communities. The winners are Institute for Safe Families in Philadelphia, Piedmont Health Services and Sickle Cell Agency, Restoration Place Ministries, the Servant Center Incorporated, and the Triad Health Project, all based in Greensboro. Habitat for Humanity of Durham joined the Bostic family in dedicating their new home in Durham, the first Home for the Holidays construction project. Home for the Holidays is a collaboration with Durham Habitat, the streets at South Point, Belk, and ABC 11 to build affordable housing for Durham neighbors. In July, Valdivia Construction framed the home at the streets at South Point, and in August, the home was moved to its permanent location in East Durham by Builders First Source. Junior Achievement of Eastern North Carolina received a grant of $25,000 from the Walmart Foundation. The grant funds will allow Junior Achievement to bring financial literacy, entrepreneurship, and workforce readiness programs to more than 1,000 students in Eastern North Carolina. And now the Philanthropy News Desk column written by Todd Cohen. The headline on the column, At 30, Planned Parenthood Affiliate Going Strong. And also included with the column, there's a picture, a large picture of a woman in business attire. The caption reads, Planned Parenthood's founding CEO, Janet Kalm, runs a $5 million operation. When it opened its first health center in 1983 in Hillsborough, Planned Parenthood of Central North Carolina was greeted with open arms by many people in the community who really saw the need for our services, says Janet Kalm, the agency's founding CEO. But that event also attracted picketers opposed to the family planning services the agency offers. That mixed response has followed Planned Parenthood ever since and continues to represent a challenge as the agency prepares to celebrate its 30th anniversary. In fact, the local affiliate has selected the Enraged But Not Yet Engaged as its theme for 2013, which also will mark the 40th anniversary of the landmark Roe v. Wade decision by the U.S. Supreme Court that found the constitutional right to privacy extended to a woman's decision to have an abortion. Planned Parenthood will spend the year working to recruit new patients, supporters, and donors, says Lori Scott, Vice President for Development. Operating with an annual budget of nearly $5 million and a staff of 66 employees, the agency served 10,000 male and female patients at its health centers in Durham, Fayetteville, and Chapel Hill in the fiscal year ended June 30, and attracted 94,000 visitors to its website. Serving 25 counties, the Planned Parenthood affiliate provides services ranging from cancer screening, treatment for sexually transmitted diseases, and abortion services to breast health, pregnancy testing, and education. Wake and Eastern counties are served by Planned Parenthood Health Systems Incorporated, a different local affiliate. It also provides training each year for nearly 100 young women and men on topics that include sex and sexuality, life skills, and substance abuse so they can educate their peers on those topics. And it is actively engaged in advocacy and public policy work. Advocacy continues to play an important role for the agency in a field fraught with controversy, particularly over the issues of family planning, contraception, and abortion. In 2011, for example, after state lawmakers passed a bill to cut off all state funding to Planned Parenthood, the agency obtained a court injunction to stop the law from going into effect and eventually won the case, an effort that preserved roughly $200,000 in funding. And in 2012, after state lawmakers passed a bill that barred state funds for family planning from going to nonprofits, a move that cost Planned Parenthood $155,000, the affiliate applied directly to the federal government for funds and secured $426,000 for its Durham Health Center. After Dallas-based Komen for the Cure announced earlier this year it no longer would fund Planned Parenthood, a decision it quickly reversed, the affiliate landed 700 donors without any solicitation, although Kalm emphasizes the affiliate never had a fight with Komen, which does good work and important work. The problem, she says, was the bullies who bullied them into making that decision. The funding changes and controversies of recent years underscore the value of Planned Parenthood, Kalm says. One in five American women has a Planned Parenthood client, she says. One in five American women has been a Planned Parenthood client, she says. We owe it to the public that we're going to be here no matter what, and we're going to care for people no matter what. And now the People on the Move section. Tress Vance, CEO of Advance Company Incorporated, was named to the Youth Villages North Carolina Leadership Council. Youth Villages is a nonprofit that works to help children and families live successfully. William Barker of Barker Realty Incorporated, Kathy Moore of the Wake County Public School System, Frederick Zufelt of Nelson Mullins, Kimberly Durland, Terry DeMattis of Rex Healthcare, Barbara Doolittle of North State Bank, and Bill Cerami of Lord Corporation were named to the Alice A. Koch Poe Center for Health Education's Board of Directors. The Poe Center is a nonprofit organization dedicated to positively impacting the lives of North Carolina youth through health education. And now we'll read from a special section in this edition of the Triangle Business Journal called Deals, Debacles, and Dollars, 2012 Top Stories. It's a collection of about 10 short stories, along with many pictures of the people involved. The first story is headlined, After Much Drama, Duke Completes Progress By. And this one is number one, written by Chris Bagley. The completion of Progress Energy Incorporated's $32 billion merger into Duke Energy Corporation had the potential to be the top story of the year, even as fireworks burst over Progress's two towers in downtown Raleigh at the stroke of midnight. For starters, the combined company would become the nation's largest electrical utility. At the same time, the merger stoked an old rivalry between North Carolina's capital and its largest city. There was the bite of Raleigh losing its largest corporate headquarters to Charlotte, albeit leavened by a widely known software company's plans to relocate into the very building that Progress was vacating. Finally, there was a twinge of pride that Progress CEO Bill Johnson was scheduled to take over as the new Duke's CEO. Those, after all, were the reasons why Triangle Business Journal made the merger its number one story of 2011, the year when it was announced and began to take shape. But the story took a spectacular turn on July 2nd, just hours after the merger closed. Johnson was out, and Duke Chairman Jim Rogers was back in the CEO role. A series of high-level defections followed, and so did a five-month investigation by the North Carolina Utilities Commission. The investigation, in turn, ended in an unprecedented settlement. The company had to get a new general counsel. Rogers would retire by the end of 2013, and Duke promised to keep 1,000 employees in downtown Raleigh, as many as 300 more than it otherwise might have. A range of pundits and corporate governance watchers decried the terms as a chilling example of governmental interference in the private sector. The Utilities Commission exceeded enormously what it's supposed to do, says Dan Fogel, a professor of strategy and corporate governance at Wake Forest University's Charlotte site. It sends a message about the business climate in North Carolina. Duke lost as much as $5.5 million in market value while the investigation was underway. It recovered nearly half of that following the settlement. Meanwhile, Johnson will once again run a utility nearly as large as Rogers and with bordering service territory, the Tennessee Valley Authority, the federally owned corporation that provides electricity to virtually all of Tennessee and large swaths of Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, and Kentucky. At a press conference in early November, TVA announced that Johnson would succeed its retiring CEO at the end of 2012. Questions about Duke's boardroom coup followed Johnson even then. "We were engaged in a merger. The merger got contentious, and at the end of the merger, Duke decided they didn't want me as CEO," said Johnson, who left Duke with a $10 million severance package and about $34 million in accrued compensation. "My view of that is that that was their right to do." Number two, Wake Med fails to buy Rex, UNC to invest in Wake County. And this is written by Jason DeBrun. Raleigh's rival hospitals made news again this year when they announced they would play nice, sort of. In 2011, Wake Med Health and Hospitals made an unsolicited bid to buy Rex Healthcare, a UNC healthcare subsidiary, and its debt for $875 million in cash. UNC healthcare officials did not take kindly to the move, and animosity simmered between the two hospital systems for months. On May 22, Wake Med agreed to withdraw its bid. In return, UNC Healthcare agreed to invest $30 million to develop and operate a 28-bed inpatient psychiatric facility in Wake County to help address crisis and emergency demand, something of which Wake Med CEO Bill Atkinson has said that Wake Med shouldered a disproportionate burden. UNC Healthcare also will commit a total of $10 million over 5 years to support additional mental health services. That day, Atkinson and UNC Healthcare CEO Dr. Bill Roper shook hands in the legislative building on Jones Street, something that was hard to imagine in 2011. In November, UNC Healthcare made its first move toward its commitment when it agreed to take over operations of Wakebrook Center in Raleigh and applied to add 16 inpatient psychiatric beds at the facility, which means it can treat psychiatric patients in a hospital setting as opposed to only at a residential setting. In a letter of support, Atkinson wrote, "These patients often remain in a hospital emergency department for several days and sometimes weeks waiting for placement in a state or private psychiatric or substance abuse facility," but made clear that 16 beds was only the first step toward the commitment of adding 28 new beds in Wake County. Mental or behavioral health patients in Wake County and North Carolina have been increasingly bogging down emergency rooms. The North Carolina Hospital Association's Don Dalton has long said mental health patients take up an inordinate amount of care in emergency rooms across the state, and on separate occasions has called mental health care a critical need in this county and state. Number three, Conexion liquidates after burning $550 million. This article is written by Lauren K. Onsorge. With $467.5 million in debt and big name investors such as SaaS CEO Jim Goodnight out millions, Carrie's Connection Technologies was the Triangle's largest bankruptcy of 2012. The company, founded by former Carrie Mayor Glenn Lang in 2012, laid off more than half of its then 455 employees in March. Executive Vice President Matt Springer said at the time that the cutback followed difficulty in raising capital. The company had $69 million in revenue in 2011. We can't fully fund our business plan for the year, Springer said in March. We have to take very serious action. It's a very sad day here. The days were about to get sadder. By the end of April, the company had filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. In June, a U.S. bankruptcy judge in Delaware approved the sale of almost all of the telecom's assets for about $20 million. Connection Technologies had spent more than $550 million over 10 years with little to show for the trouble. A $453 million investment made in Connection by Reedy Creek Investments was gone. Reedy Creek's investors include SaaS co-founders Goodnight and John Saul. A $105 million investment made by Germany's UniCredit Group, Bank of America, and Raleigh's Capital Bank was also flushed, save for $20 million in proceeds the banks netted from the fire sale. The trouble appeared to be the business model, which relied heavily on new housing communities where Connection would install and operate cable, telephone, and internet services. The 2008 housing slowdown caused a scaleback, and despite efforts by Connection to change its focus toward working directly with companies such as DirecTV, the company tanked. Number four, UNC Chancellor Thorpe resigns amidst scandal. This article written by Jason DeBrun. Academic improprieties in the football program and misconduct in the fundraising department of UNC Chapel Hill proved too much for Chancellor Holden Thorpe to survive this year. He announced his resignation on September 17, sent shockwaves throughout the UNC community and higher education across the nation. Within hours of the announcement, administrators, trustees, and members of the University of North Carolina system asked, even implored, Thorpe to stay, but he held firm in his decision and still plans to step down June 30, 2013. He says he plans to return to teaching chemistry. In a statement, Thorpe said, "I will always do what is best for this university. This wasn't an easy decision personally, but when I thought about the university and how important it's been to me, to North Carolinians, and to hundreds of thousands of alumni, my answer became clear." The first set of dominoes to fall at UNC surrounded players on the football team who apparently received favorable academic treatment, particularly in the Afro and African-American Studies Department. In 2011, the chairman of that department, Julius Niang Oro, resigned, and UNC Chapel Hill officials said they closed the book on what at the time seemed to be a fairly isolated incident. Later, however, the transcript of former football standout Julius Pepper surfaced, which seemed to indicate that academic improprieties possibly dated back to the 1990s. A second investigation was launched, NCAA sanctions were handed down, and the university admitted to academic improprieties. Still, it wasn't until after information surfaced about questionable travel expenses by Matt Kupek, the top fundraiser at UNC Chapel Hill, and Tammy Hansbrough, former basketball standout Tyler Hansbrough's mother, who was romantically linked with Kupek, that Thorpe resigned. Former Governor Jim Martin led a team that delved into potential academic improprieties and found problems in some 216 courses. He put the blame on the academic side of the house. Number five, McCrory win gives GOP total control in North Carolina. Written by Lee Weisbecker. Some have dubbed it the dawn of a new era, others the springboard for a red state resurgence. Call it what you might, January will see Republican Governor Pat McCrory of Charlotte roll into town to greet a GOP-controlled legislature. McCrory is only the state's third Republican governor since 1901. James Holzhauser served 4 years between 1973 and 1977, when governors could only serve one term, and Charlotte's Jim Martin was chief executive between 1985 and 1993. The GOP took control of both houses of the General Assembly in 2010 for the first time in 140 years, but consolidated its hold in the most recent elections. It will be up to McCrory to make the first move in redirecting the course of state spending. The legislature, which reconvenes on January 9, traditionally waits on the governor to write a budget plan before beginning to craft any of its own. For his part, McCrory has simply said he plans to look for ways of getting the state's economy moving again, but has issued few specifics. If his past record is any indication, don't look for a major upheaval. While wielding the gavel during multiple terms as Charlotte's mayor, McCrory was known as a moderate who sought out bipartisan support for such middle-of-the-road projects as a light rail line, and a NASCAR museum. His task as governor should be somewhat simplified by the fact that, as the early numbers indicate, the economy of the Old North State has indeed been on the mend for months now. In fact, through the first 5 months of the current fiscal year, 2013, state tax and non-tax revenue is nearly $307 million ahead of where it was in the comparable period in 2011, according to State Controller David McCoy. All of the economy-based taxes, sales, payroll, and corporate are firing ahead of where they were last year, a sign of better days to come. If that trend holds through spring, McCrory won't have to face a budget shortfall. But even with better numbers to work with, the new governor will be facing a few thorny issues. A couple of matters on the state's plate include finalizing a plan to repay the $2.5 billion it borrowed from the federal government to pay unemployment benefits during the worst of the recession, and satisfying all of the provisions attendant with the actual arrival of the Affordable Care Act. Much talk post-election has also centered on the likelihood of tax reform. It could be on the table, says UNC Chapel Hill Center for Competitive Economics Director Brent Lane, who in November was invited to appear before a key legislative committee to talk about the issue. One topic drawing attention has been whether the state should begin moving toward a greater reliance on consumption or sales taxes and away from its traditional dependence on personal income, mostly payroll taxes. Expect McCrory to move cautiously on that one, however. State officials, once they are in positions of responsibility, generally move like molasses before they adopt radical tax changes. Personal income taxes, after all, represent roughly 55.3% of total state tax revenue. Number 6. BioCryst falters, $185 million of taxpayer money gone. Written by Lauren K. Onsorge. The bad news kept coming for Research Triangle-based BioCryst Pharmaceuticals in 2012. This time last year, the company was immersed in developing Paramivir, a flu treatment whose development was backed by as much as $235 million in federal government money. The company was also developing a promising preclinical candidate for hepatitis C, as well as touting its late-stage gout candidate, for which it was searching for a partner. Flash forward to November, and the bad news started rolling in on CEO John Stonehouse. Trials of Paramivir were suspended, despite the government having already spent more than $185 million in taxpayer funds on the project. The preclinical application for the hepatitis C treatment was suspended. A highly anticipated merger with San Francisco-based Presidio Pharmaceuticals Incorporated was terminated, despite Stonehouse's prior assertions to investors that it would go forward as scheduled. And the gout candidate? Still in limbo with no development partner in sight. The company's stock price plummeted, and in December, BioCryst cut its workforce in half in an effort to salvage cash. And in 2013, it could get a lot worse for the 37 remaining employees, half of whom work at the RTP campus. The company is refocusing its efforts toward three candidates. The hepatitis C candidate is among them. Going through a revamped chimp trial, the company hopes will fare better than the first go-round. A preclinical cardio drug targeted at angioedema that's already seen a delay is another focus. The third asset being looked at is an antiviral targeted initially at yellow fever that's dependent on government funding. All three are preclinical, and there are two scenarios for BioCryst going forward, analysts say. Either the refocusing works or it doesn't. The latter outcome would bring the future of the entire company into question. As for the Pyramavir suspension, Stonehouse and team are meeting with their government sponsors in January to determine what, if anything, the compound's future will be. And the gout asset? Still on hold until BioCryst nets a backer. Number 7, Red Hat Creek crossed $1 billion revenue mark. Written by Amanda Jones Hoyle. Two of the Triangle region's highest-profile companies, Durham-based Cree and Raleigh-based Red Hat, joined the exclusive billion-dollar club in 2012. Each company passed the $1 billion mark in annual revenue for the first time in its history. Together, the companies have a combined market capitalization of $13.6 billion and employ more than 10,500 people worldwide, including nearly 3,000 people in the Triangle. The companies have also helped establish the Triangle as a leader in technology, with Cree's light-emitting diodes and semiconductor chips found in products all around the world, and with Red Hat's Linux open-source software programs used by businesses across the U.S., and quickly expanding across the globe. Red Hat opened its first office in China in 2012. Red Hat, which was founded in 1993, announced in March that it had achieved $1.13 billion in revenue in the fiscal year that ended February 29, a 25% increase over the previous year. Red Hat is the first vendor in the open source software market to achieve the $1 billion milestone, but the company is steadily reinventing itself as a cloud computing company, and it has been eyeing more expansion in China. Red Hat enjoys a $10.4 billion market capitalization as of December 24, and employs more than 5,000 people worldwide, including about 750 in the Triangle. The company moved its headquarters from NCSU's Centennial Campus to Red Hat Tower in downtown Raleigh earlier this year. And for Cree, which celebrated its 25th anniversary this year, announced in August that it had ended fiscal year 2012 with total revenue of $1.16 billion, an 18% increase over the previous year's $988 million. Cree was started when a group of researchers from North Carolina State University brought the first blue LED to market in 1989, and it remains one of the leaders in the LED lighting and semiconductor markets worldwide. But it has also started migrating toward a focus on production of products that use LED chips versus the production of the chips themselves. Cree employs more than 5,500 people worldwide, including about 2,000 full-time employees in Durham, devoted to research and development, manufacturing, sales, marketing, and other professional support roles. The company had a market capitalization of $3.9 billion as of December 24. And we'll stop there and with our remaining minutes, turn to the TriangleBusinessJournal.com. Here's some of the news you may have missed on TBJ's website. Paragon Bank names Matt Davis COO. Raleigh Business Bank Paragon Commercial has tapped Matt Davis as its new Chief Operating Officer. He'll oversee day-to-day operations, credit administration, and compliance. Prior to his new position, Davis served as Paragon's Chief Credit Officer for the past 10 years. Among his banking jobs before joining Paragon were stints at Wachovia in Charlotte and Centura Bank in Cary. From the foundation of Paragon, he has made key contributions to the organization and has been exceptional in working with clients in his previous position, says Paragon CEO Bob Hatley. We are confident that Matt will do the same quality of work in his new role with Paragon. Durham teardown to become apartments. A Charlotte real estate developer is tearing down the 1950s-era Washburn Court apartments on Swift Avenue in Durham to make way for a $40 million apartment community opening in 2014. A subsidiary of Faison Enterprises of Charlotte paid nearly $5.5 million for the 29-unit Washburn Court property at 300 Swift Avenue, according to Durham County Records. And Faison Development Director Chris Fetter says demolition of the nine white brick buildings has begun. Faison is planning to build a four-story wood-frame building on the site that will have 202 apartment units with structured parking underneath. The project site plan has been approved by the city, and Fetter, the company, expects to begin construction on the 3.4-acre site in January. This will be upscale luxury apartments, and we are excited about it, Fetter says. Fitch assigns AAA rating on carry bonds. Fitch Ratings, the New York-based bond rating agency, has assigned a high AAA rating to the $113.4 million revenue bond package that the town of Cary will sell in order to expand its water and sewer systems. The bonds are expected to be sold in the second week of January in a negotiated deal with investors. Part of the proceeds will be used to refinance earlier bond issues. The town will use fees generated by the systems to repay the obligation. North Carolina adds construction jobs in November. Despite fiscal cliff uncertainties, North Carolina was one of only 19 states that was able to add construction jobs between October and November, according to Associated General Contractors of America. The trade group says the state's building industry grew by 1,700 jobs during the 30 days, bringing total employment to 172,800. Looking at the industry over a larger time frame, however, a robust recovery still appears to be off in the future. For the 12 months ending in November 26, North Carolina shed 4,700 jobs, or 2.6% of the construction workforce. Gutsy investors should look at biodelivery services. It might be time for investors to give Biodelivery Services International another look. That's according to Brinson Patrick Securities Corporation Managing Director Michael Higgins, who tells the Life Sciences Report that BDSI could rack up gains for investors gutsy enough to take a chance on a smaller company. And we'll stop there as we run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.